Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we're talking about taste. Actually, we're talking about food and taste and sometimes all sorts of crazy things. But today especially, we're going to be talking about taste with the editor-in-chief of one of the game-changing food magazines, I think, certainly in my lifetime, Saveur magazine. We're here with Jim Oseland, editor-in-chief. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to see you.
Good to see you. I want to tell people at home, if you have any questions about our conversation today or really anything about food, magazines, where you should eat in New York, you know, name it all. You can call us at 718-497-2128. Operators at Roberta's here in Bushwick are standing by. Or you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. Or even more fun, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. That holds true for all of you folks listening to the podcast. We're happy to take questions after the episode, and we'll get to them on the air, or we'll tweet you back. Jim, talk to me about Saveur magazine. Talk to me about, I mean, we have a whole list of things we were going to talk about, but I think that running a magazine about food these days when everyone is online tweeting, twittering, blogging, photographing, yelping, whatever, all the things that you do, probably is different from when you started or when you arrived at Saveur.
There is a sort of, I guess, kind of quiet revolutionary quality to making a print magazine these days, right?
Radical!
Right, really, truly radical. How arcane, how crazy. You know, I first knew Saveur when it first came out, back in 1994. My former partner had brought home a copy one afternoon. I think it wasn't the very first issue. It was probably the second or third or maybe even fourth issue, but it was within that first year that the magazine was published. And immediately I was blown away. I love the term that you've just used, game changer. I mean, that's what it felt like flipping open this magazine, where it wasn't, it was like not only unlike any other food magazine that I'd seen, but it was unlike any kind of food media that I'd ever seen at that point. And I mean, across all what we now call platforms, from, you know, TV to food newspaper sections.
How
to,
so? Describe why. Because I agree.
You know, it was just this incredibly rich, vivid, almost anthropological experience. It wasn't just a recipe magazine. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't just about, oh, how much sugar to use and, you know, what trendy wine to buy this fall. Instead, it was about human culture. And actually, even in 1994 and now, Our little secret at Saveur is we're not really actually a food magazine. Instead, we're an anthropology magazine. We're a magazine about what people do, people all over the world, through this very, very specific lens of food.
It almost, as you're saying that, it reminds me, it's like the modern day version of the Time Life books, which were also these anthropological journeys, the history of the Food of the World book series, in some way, obviously with a different purpose. But
what an amazing series that was. I'm proud to say that I own all of them. And it's funny, I
and
did
the little books and the little recipe books too.
I have about half of the little recipe books that came along, you know, with the hardbound versions. I did a huge book purge about a year and a half ago, and I got rid of probably three quarters of my books. I did not get rid of my Time Life Foods of the World.
So when did you go from being surprised? When did you come to the magazine? When did you start there?
As I had worked once upon a time in the movie business. I went to film school, got a bachelor's and a master's in film, worked in the movie industry for just under 10 years, kind of got pooped out with that and found my way sort of like through a back door into journalism. I worked at the LA Weekly for a couple of years as a proofreader and fell really, really quickly and intensely very in love with the act act in the art of publishing, and eventually made my way to New York and was working at the Village Voice. I was working at Sassy. I was working at a whole bunch of different magazines. I never really necessarily wanted to write about food. I was always the food guy wherever I was, whatever I was doing. I was always the one cooking or foraging for ingredients or finding the crazy new restaurant. Always, basically since I was a teenager on. And I almost didn't want to corrupt my love for this thing by turning it into a career. Yet Sever,
did you hear that at home, everyone who wants to be a food writer? But
Sever won me over, though. And in 1997, I worked up the courage to pitch the magazine. It was really essentially the first food writing or first food pitch that I had done. And didn't hear back from the editor that I'd pitched for a year, and decided to resend the pitch. And after resending it, within a week, I got a call from the then executive editor, Christopher Hirschheimer, who said, "Hey, do you want to come in and meet everybody? We liked your pitch. Sorry for not responding for a year." and then thus began my journey at Sever from 1998 until now.
So in that time, not only have magazines and media changed drastically, but I think food and really food culture has changed tremendously. So can you talk a little bit about that?
How do you mean tremendously? Because I'm not totally sure I agree with the tremendous part.
Well, I think that the number of people who are sort of interested in food has exploded, or I would say, I mean, I don't know that the food itself has changed so much, although obviously there are trends, but I just feel like it has now become cool to be into food. I used to feel like a food geek doing some of the things that you did, and now, I mean, like in every other thing,
and now
geeks
you have
run the
now
world.
Now you have your brethren.
Right. I mean, I am sitting in a weird little shack with these geeky headphones on me having this conversation, so maybe not a lot has changed, but I don't know. It's just, I mean, the fact that I turn on Jimmy Fallon, all these things, and there's chefs and food people, to me there's something's different.
That is a little bit of a trip. The Jimmy Fallon thing, okay, I gotcha.
So tell me how you don't think it's changed. Let's go that
way.
Well,
I mean, you know, I don't know. I did this panel last night. I'm going to butcher the title of the panel, but it was basically something about have foodies jumped the shark? Basically, has foodieism just gone too far?
That should have been the title if it wasn't.
And, you know, really one of the first things out of my mouth on the panel was, wait, you know, have foodies gone too far? Because for me, it's a bit of a head scratcher. It's like foodies. Okay, well, first, let's do a little bit of a moment of pullback. What is a foodie? Who isn't a foodie? I mean, in my 49 years on this planet, I don't think that I've ever met anyone who isn't a foodie. We're all foodies in our own way. Mm-hmm. We all eat. I think maybe more specifically, maybe what you're talking about is this moment that it seems like we're in right now, here in 2012, in America, in North America, where we see this kind of, it's a kind of fetishization of the culture of food. I kind of, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of like, oh boy, you know, it prompts this kind of eye rolling aspect of my inside. On the other hand, it's kind of phenomenally cool. Mm-hmm. When you think about, like, I mean, just me, for instance, growing up in 1960s and 1970s, largely Northern California, largely suburban Northern California, lower middle class suburban Northern California, and the food mostly that I knew and thought about pretty much up until I was like 11 or 12 or 13 years old was basically, you know, Carnation instant milk and Swanson's frozen dinners, and I loved Libby's fruit cocktail, and this is what I ate. Yes, and in a way, I guess, I mean, I'm not a cultural anthropologist, but I do work in food, and I tend to think what is happening now is definitely an answer to that. It is a kind of unconscious, quiet reaction to the fact that America knows that it needs to stop eating crap, that it needs to stop eating factory food, that we need to stop, that we need to, like, just shake ourselves a little bit and get out of the terrible terrible hypnosis of you know, eating food from bags and, mm-hmm. And also thinking we can't cook. Oh, I couldn't possibly cook. Everybody can cook. Every human being of a certain age can cook. If you're old enough to stand at a stove, you can cook. We all have that potential inside of us. We may not all be able to be, Eric Repair, but we can all cook really satisfying, beautiful food that feeds us, that nourishes us and our families.
I think that's amazing. I want to stand up and actually applaud you, because I think that's so true. I was just talking with someone yesterday, Jane Black, who's a journalist in mm-hmm. sustainability and various things. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this, maybe something that resonates with what you just said, how there are no foodies in France and Italy or Japan or Malaysia.
Or Indonesia.
There's just a relationship to the food that is, as you said, that comes with a bit of a conscience, the way I characterized it, this is food. It isn't widgets. It's not the same. And the decisions that you make because of that ought to be different.
Right, right. You know, it's really interesting. This is actually something I was just sort of, I'm not exactly sure why, but I was flashing on it over the last few days. But I lived for about a year and a half in South India, in the state of Kerala, mm-hmm. In the very, very northern part of the state. I lived in a town. It was a town of probably about 75,000 people. Part of that time, and the other part of the time, I lived in a village about an hour, hour and a half outside of the town, basically in the middle of the rice paddies, in the middle of nowhere. I was living in someone's home, in a family's home, and we were eating this incredibly pure, wonderful food. Really, it's no exaggeration. Everything that we were eating was grown, or the cows were milked, all within a half a mile. It's mm-hmm. basically like, for a lot of us, I guess I could call us foodies, or fetishizers of right. food here in North America. It's basically like our dream to be able to live like that. And I'll tell you, I've never been healthier. Mm. It was just an extraordinary diet, pure vegetarian, just amazingly clean, beautiful food. So much of the time, though, and here's the crazy part, my hosts, especially at the beginning, were kind of embarrassed that they weren't serving me, that they weren't serving me Wonder Bread, and they weren't serving right. or the South Indian version of Wonder Bread.
I was going to ask, that's a really important point, I think.
You know, do you want Coca-Cola? Right. Well, no, actually, I don't. I do kind of have a secret liking for Coca-Cola. I like to indulge in it once or twice a year, sure. but certainly I didn't want to be drinking it in the South Indian village. And it's just funny when you think about it.
Part of what that makes me want to ask you is, how much of that is, I mean, part of that must be because they wanted to be great hosts for you and presume that you wanted those things, but also one of the challenges I think is that the model of progress in the world we've created vis-a-vis food is mass-produced
factory food.
Like, that's yeah. progress. I have a great friend yeah. actually upstate, who's a chef, Danyo, on Seneca Lake, and his mother also, she made her own foie gras. He's Ukrainian, and she made right. her own foie gras, and they grew all mm-hmm. their own things. And when the guests came, she took out the dried egg white powder right. from America.
Absolutely.
So what do we do? What is it?
Well, you know what we do is we just cook. And I think really what it is, you know, we're hypnotized. We're hypnotized by, these folks that I'm remembering in South India, they weren't great TV watchers back then. Actually, a lot of these people now have cable TV, and they can watch a lot of the same mm-hmm. programs that we do, even Food Network programs in South India, of all places. But I think that there's something about the kind of subtle hypnotizing of us that corporations do to us, right. that advertising does
to us. Also,
yeah, sure. You know, and there are all sorts of systems and people who are just really, really masterful at hypnotizing us and making us think we want this, you know. And I think that, you know, what we can do, those fabulous fetishizers of food here in America, I think that the sort of, you know, really the truly revolutionary thing that we can do is just make dinner. Just make dinner for our friends and family.
Well, on that, while you go and buy those ingredients, we're going to take a quick break. Remember, you can call us at 718-497-2128 or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com.
I'm a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the whine, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries. They cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information. And be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we're talking with Saveur magazine editor-in-chief, James Osland. Glenn Campbell. Thank you. Thanks for reminding us about that.
You know, I have to be frank. I hated that song as a kid with just a kind of unearthly passion. I can remember, you know, driving to the supermarket with my mom in the Harvest Gold station wagon, and that would be playing, or like the Muzak version of that song would be playing, and it would just make me so depressed. And I just recently rediscovered it with my partner, actually now husband. We got married, Daniel and I did. Thank you very much. In late December, and I can't remember where Daniel and I bumped into the song. Daniel's from Brazil, so he doesn't have those same relationships to a lot of kind of corny American music like I do. He just thinks it is as beautiful music. And so through Daniel's ears, I started to hear what an incredible piece of American music this song is. What a beautiful piece of poetry that conjures so many gorgeous images. And I'm sorry, Glenn Campbell's voice.
Awesome. Well, I love the way that you just described that as sort of seeing it through someone else's ear, listening to it through someone else's ears. And since taste is in fact a sense, I'm wondering if that relates in some way to tasting things through someone else's palate, their sensations. Have I mean, either your partner, or can you talk perhaps about some new thoughts about taste through someone else's palate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can just think of my own experience. Like, you know, here I am, basically, I'm moving back a couple of decades in time, and I'm this, you know, kid who was raised pretty much on frozen food and pot roast. You know, I'm just like the typical American
kid.
Like,
yes,
basically,
yeah,
most of us across, you know, all races and economic classes. This is what we are as Americans. This is the food culture that we share. And I made my first trip abroad when I was 19 years old to Southeast Asia, to Indonesia. And a friend had invited me from college in San Francisco, an Indonesian friend. And I went what was to be just for a couple of months, but actually ended up staying a heck of a long time. I have to say, though, those first couple of weeks especially, I was just really, really stunned. There was no point of reference. The heat, the language, the dirt, the noise, the everything, and then the food. And it was just like, it was really startling food. This was not what I thought Southeast Asian food was. It was like sometimes intensely bitter and intensely hot and intensely funky and fishy smelling and just intense all around. And gradually, you know, there were a couple of moments, you know, that were absolutely like epiphany moments, but like I kind of came into this food. And through like tasting these like really, really exaggerated flavors and textures too, I began to understand what this place that up until those moments was just completely forbidding and foreign. And I mean, that in a way that sort of evokes a thing for me that you were talking about, where it's like just going inside someone else or something else to just understand it anew. My palate, you know, was completely turned around and has never been the same since.
Well, we're grateful for that, I think, as a culture.
Got rid of all that carnation instant milk or instant breakfast. It all went away after that trip to Indonesia.
but we forget, I think. I mean, that's a good point that I often try to make, is that we spend a lot of time thinking about developing tastes in children, and we forget adult tastes change all the time.
All the time.
Yes, we...
Actually, Daniel, my now husband, is a point in case, because... This is so crazy because I of course, am like, you know, I live, breathe food 24 hours a day, obsessively. I live to cook. Cooking is just, it's my favorite thing in the world to do. It's the if I had to pick and choose of all the millions of things that I do in my life, the cooking is the one thing that I would just absolutely keep. And Daniel's palate, I mean, I think maybe he's one of those super tasters, but he's just, you know, there are a lot of tastes and flavors. He's open to try anything, but like the door shuts sometimes real quickly. And so like in the beginning of our relationship, I was like, I don't know, this is freaking me out. I don't know what to cook. Oh my God, I don't know what to do.
Or is this going
to
work?
Is this going to work? Absolutely. I mean, I was just absolutely, totally, completely freaking out. And I'll tell you, as God is my witness, I won that guy over on garlic and onions and next stop cilantro and fennel. That's going to take a couple of years because he has this just like livid dislike for these flavors that I love so much. But eventually, I'm going to bring him over to the
other
side.
We're all rooting for you and for Daniel, because think of all the new things that he will get to enjoy. Let's talk about this awful word that everyone wants to use and knows they shouldn't, but authenticity in food and taste and flavors. And I know, I think one of the things that it's part of the tagline of your magazine, but I also think it is the part of thing that people first resonated when they saw Sever, that this anthropology, as you described it, was more authentic somehow than the staged party in the beautiful Aspen home that we had come to expect in a magazine. So, I mean, what do you do with it?
I always look at those layouts in not only some food magazines, but just like lifestyle magazines in general, those Aspen spreads that you're talking about. And I'm always kind of like, did I leave my bomb at home? You know, it's funny because, yeah, you're right. Sever's tagline is savor a world of authentic cuisine. And it's something, you know, that we talk about sort of endlessly at the magazine. And sometimes you can belabor that word and really kind of overthink it. And sometimes it just sort of like, you just kind of know what it means. On the one hand, it's sort of silly. But I mean, hey, these are words. They're all kind of silly if you think about them too long. But it's like... You know, what is authentic? And in fact, what isn't authentic is a sort of better question. But I think what we've, you know, I can specifically talk about what we do at the magazine, which is rather than, say, run some kind of, you know, a recipe that is a kind of like a I don't know. I guess I don't mean this to, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, and I don't want to say anything, I don't want to sound too negative with this, but like a kind of frippery, a sort of like, you know, oh, we're going to combine a little lemongrass with a little beaten egg white and then a little vanilla, and then we're going to throw in some, you know, some pepper, what are those long peppercorns, and we're going to make, you know, just that kind of like
a creme brulee.
inventive food. We instead try to focus on what we just sort of collectively agree are these sort of like baseline foods that really speak of a place or of a person and don't seem like they were invented 5 minutes ago or don't seem like they were invented just to like kind of like do a sort of jazz hands recipe and we're gonna turn you on with like how fabulous and interesting this recipe is, yay. But instead for us it's just so endlessly interesting, you know, food ways that have been around for a while, and some in fact which are really ancient, like these some of these foods that I'm thinking about that I encountered in Indonesia, mm-hmm. or in South India. Some of these dishes have probably been eaten pretty uninterrupted for like thousands, mm-hmm. of years, literally, maybe with the addition of a few extra ingredients, chilies that weren't there before, you know, 5-6 centuries ago. But you know, that's so interesting a story to begin with. I guess at Savour, we feel that, you know, why mess with that? Those, mm-hmm. stories are sort of so endless and inspirational anyway. Let's focus on those. Let's let that be our work. These so-called authentic recipes and food ways. But of course, they're no more authentic than the avant-garde chef, you know, who's making these fantastical creations. That too is authentic. And so is the Carnation Instant Breakfast. I have that like on my brain today, don't
That's
I?
That's funny, you do.
You know, maybe I need it.
But can we pop that? Maybe Roberta's has one. You know, it's funny. I love this point because that would have factored into some of the recipes and does, in fact, when you look at, the Mexican flan or the condensed milk and all the sorts of things that have, you know, would fall into the category of the way that things are done now for a long time, not just yesterday, but they're part of that culture. As you said, everything is authentic.
Well, you know what? I guess for me as a cook, I would rather learn to start with what I believe to be a kind of a baseline recipe, a spaghetti alla bolognese or a particular kind of Indonesian chicken curry, a classic Indonesian chicken curry. I would kind of want to know how to make that dish and really understand its components, understand why the cook uses the lemongrass or the pancetta in the way they use it, why they sizzle out the meat in the way that they sizzle out the meat. I want to know these things, mm-hmm. as a curious cook, then I'm going to go and make, you know, adaptations and create my own, mm-hmm. authenticity in the kitchen.
And that's a great point too, I think, that we often mistake, we pop in, we're great poppers in, tradition. And in fact, I'm just thinking of El Bulli, which was a restaurant, you know, the most modern, most avant-garde, but also in some ways the most grounded in the traditions of those places, that if you were from there, meant something very different to be eating them in that way than it did when you just, mm-hmm. popped in from anywhere in the world to have dinner. So there is that authenticity in some ways informs a context that gives some meaning to what's going on.
I'm personally a great believer in not popping in and really sitting down. And you don't have to be like an academic. You don't have to study lemongrass and its uses in Southeast Asian cuisine. You don't have to
chapter
do that.
One.
But really just do try and get some fundamental understandings of what a particular ingredient or a particular food or food way. You know, if something's been going along for 2,000 or 3,000 years, there's probably something about it that works.
Yes.
And in America, we are so constantly hungry to reinvent and quickly, it's like, well, that's okay, but we can make it better.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, sometimes there is a real profound thing in looking at what's been around for a while.
And conversely, sometimes what's been around for a while isn't so good. I think. Sometimes, no.
Like what?
Oh, I don't know. Sometimes you go the way something, I'm thinking, I must have had an experience somewhere in Italy where it's like, yeah, that's okay. But, you know, that's how we do it here. It's like, yeah, I would add some butter. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But anyway, no, just teasing with you. In the last couple of minutes that we have, it dawns on me that perhaps maybe more people know you from your work on television on Top Chef Masters, which as one of the great judges, one of the you are one of the great
the
judges.
The most disliked judges, I would.
But disliked for all the right reasons, because you are tough and because you're looking for something, I think, that we're talking about now that isn't just, will this win the judges, but actually, is there anything behind the thing you've just made? What's that experience like? I mean,
you know, it's a kind of blast, honestly. It really is. I mean, you know, it's a dream job. It's like you're, you know, you're eating this amazing food in these crazy locations, you know, cooked by these absolutely extraordinary chefs. And I mean, it's friggin' awesome. It really genuinely
that's
is.
Nice to hear.
Yeah.
That's great. And I do. I believe strongly that watching people like you and Jeff Steingarten and Gail Simmons and Tom Colicchio and all the people who have been, who are discussing taste, who are really talking about dishes in front of people, is a really important moment for us as a culture and food to see that conversation happen.
You know, it's funny because sometimes I guess I do come off a little harsh hard on that show. Gosh, if people had any idea how hard I was on myself and my own cooking that I would say do on Saturday night and how I would dissect. It's just a nature of, that's just who I am. It's just my sort of essential character. I like to challenge and raise the bar and figure out like what went right and what went wrong. And you know, really at the end of the day, what tastes good to me, it's completely subjective, because something that I might find like to be just so perfectly executed and just so delicious, you, Mitch, might be like,
well, and on that note, our half hour has come to an end. We are glad and grateful that you apply your powers of perfection to a wonderful magazine and to all the things you do, increasingly electronic books and great, an amazing blog, actually, all sorts of great stuff. We will be next week, actually, guest host will be here, Isabella Wojcik, who was here a few months ago and everyone enjoyed. We'll be talking about historic tastes a little bit with a chef who has been looking back at old recipes, whose name is Jonathan Sawyer, actually, from Cleveland. Until then, you can download us on iTunes, or you can listen to us on the archive at heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Mitchell Davis, and remember that taste matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.